Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Major Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is Defending Our Homeland, DoD's number one priority, focusing on U.S. Army North, our North, missions of homeland defense and defense support of civil authorities, including projecting power in a contested environment. We welcome Lieutenant General John Evans, Commanding General of United States Army North, 5th Army, out of Joint Base San Antonio, Texas. Prior to assuming command at U.S. Army North, Lieutenant General Evans served as the Commanding General of U.S. Army Cadet Command from 2018 to 2021. Throughout his career, Lieutenant General Evans has served the nation for over 35 years as an Army Special Operations Aviator with multiple combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. We also welcome Mr. Matt Farmer here from CAD. He is a retired infantry officer and currently works in Operational Level Doctrine Division. He was one of the primary authors of FM3O Operations. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lisa. Great to be here.
Thanks, Lisa.
General Evans, I'd like to start off with you.
Sure.
I think we probably have some listeners who are not familiar with Our North. So if you could talk Our North mission and the background of your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. There are lots of people that aren't necessarily familiar with Army North as a household name. As a recovering Trudosian, it's nice to be here on the podcast with you. I appreciate that. So Army North is one of the five regional Army Service Component Commands. So I think most people are familiar with U.S. Army Europe Africa that works for UCOM, and they're familiar with U.S. Army Pacific that works for Indo-PACOM, and my brothers at U.S. Army South, Will Thigpen, works for SOUTHCOM, General Pat Frank works for CENTCOM. I'm the component commander for United States Northern Command. My boss, General Glenn Van Herk, is dual-hatted as the NORTHCOM commander, so he has regional combatant command authorities, as you might expect, here in the homeland. But he's also the commander of North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, which, aside from tracking Santa Claus during Christmas, has the responsibility to conduct continental defense with our Canadian allies to the north. Army North is an Army Service Component Command, so we do all the things that are invested in Army Service Component Commands. We also serve as the theater army for NORTHCOM, and we are currently the designated Joint Force Land Component Commander, the JFLC, for NORTHCOM, and we have been since the advent of COVID. The history of the command is really short. Army North, 5th Army, takes its lineage from World War II, stood up in 1943 in Morocco. But later, after mobilizing for World War II, coming back to the States, it did a number of missions and finally ended up as one of the two commands in our Army that did the mobilization and training for Compo 2 and 3. 1st Army Division did that on the eastern side of the United States. 5th Army did it on the western side of the United States. And then after 9/11, and once we built U.S. Northern Command as a combatant command, and really you saw in the Katrina era, in the post-Katrina era, the Army decided that they needed to give NORTHCOM its own ASCC. So they took our mission for mobilization of reserve forces away from us and gave it all to 1st Army. And then 1st Army has two divisions now, East and West. They do that mission, and we have been since about 2005 the Army Service Component Command for NORTHCOM. So we do the day-to-day activities of defense support to civil authorities, but principally we are responsible for defense of the homeland.
Thanks, sir. Before we talk a little bit more about your mission, because this is Breaking Doctrine, I want to talk a little bit doctrine.
Sure.
So I look forward pulling to that. Up some pubs. The primary pubs are joint pubs. JP3-28 talks defense support of civil authorities, and JP3-27 talks homeland defense. And then also in our own publication, FM3O, we have Appendix C, which is contested deployments, and that throughout mentions homeland defense and DISCO. So going back to those joint pubs, I want to kind of give a definition for homeland defense. It's the protection of U.S. sovereignty, territory, but also domestic population and critical infrastructure against external threats and aggression of other threats, as directed by the president. And doctrine says DOD is responsible for homeland defense. DOD is the lead for homeland defense. And I think you're probably going to talk a little bit about that later.
There's some challenges with that, but yeah, absolutely.
But then DISCA is that other side, and DOD's role, in according to JP3-27, is more of a support. We support the civil authorities, whether that's Department of Homeland Security, other government agencies, and we also support state, local, or tribal entities during emergencies. I think it's also interesting to note that both missions, you know, in according to doctrine, can occur in parallel, but they require extensive integration and synchronization with those homeland security operations. So that being said, sir, although they can, those missions can run parallel, why is it important for us to be able to differentiate those if they're running in parallel or if they're not running in parallel?
Yeah, it's a good question. So what I would tell you is principally the requirement to differentiate them comes for two reasons. Number one would be the authorities, and then where there are authorities, money generally follows. And the second is something that you talked about just a minute ago when you referred to the doctrine, and that is while the Department of Defense is the lead for Homeland Defense, during a defense support to civil authorities event, Department of Defense is never in the lead. Someone else is the lead federal agency. That's generally going to be the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the guise of the Department of Homeland Security. So those are the reasons that we see a bit of a bifurcation. Now, what I will tell you, Lisa, is as we moved into kind of the new age, the post-war years, and we've looked really at the competition phase that we're in right now with our chief competitors, the PRC and Russia, we believe that that line, that bifurcation between DISCA and Homeland Defense is going to become increasingly blurred because our adversaries, should an attack occur in the homeland, will be able to present challenges to us in the form of asymmetric attacks that will likely occur in the less physical domains, the more temporal domains, cyber and space, that will manifest themselves as DISCA events. Take Colonial Pipeline, for instance, as an example. very much an event that we attribute to a cyber attack, created significant fuel supply challenges on the East Coast, which led to civil strife and other challenges for state and local authorities. Although we did not employ Title 10 forces in support of that event, we very well could have been asked to, in which case you would have found us providing DISCA support to state, local, or federal forces because of an event that was clearly an attack on the homeland. So that clear line drawn between 327 and 328 will become increasingly blurred, in my opinion, as we move forward. That's vexing for our policymakers because, like I said, authorities and money are tied to those things, and that's one of the challenges with doctrine.
I can see in that DISCA environment, we're supporting, whereas, you know, we're the Army. We like to charge ahead. We like to be the leaders.
Absolutely.
Have you seen kind of real-world examples of, hey, Army leader, you're in support, and how they deal with that?
Yeah, so we, number one, we have very capable federal agencies, don't get me wrong. Our dedicated servants at FEMA, at HHS, at DHS, incredibly smart people with a lot of training and a lot of know-how. Now, they aren't steeped in planning like we often are. You know, it's kind of part of our developmental roles as officers and NCOs in the Army that we just get planning. Everything we do is kind of a thought exercise in planning. But what I will tell you is when we are supporting a DISCA event, I'll use a relatively recent example. 2 years ago after our precipitous withdrawal from Afghanistan, we provided support to our Afghan allies, the people that had supported us for 20 years, interpreters and contractors and others that wanted to immigrate to the United States. And we conducted an operation that became known as Operation Allies Welcome. It was Allies Response first, I think, and then Allies Welcome. And we set up in the United States, 8 different installations, reception stations, if you will, for about 80,000 Afghans that eventually made their way to the United States. Even though the Department of Homeland Security was the lead federal agency for that operation, they just did not have the real estate, the know-how, or the support and logistics required to be able to house and feed and help process these folks. That fell to DOD. So it went to U.S. NORTHCOM, and NORTHCOM looked at their JFLIC and said, "R. North, you've got this." So we set up those installations across the United States. At one time, I had two Air Force commanders working for me. I had a Marine Corps commander working for me, 5 Army commanders working for me, many of whom were also commanding generals or were running installations in their own right. But they were reporting back up to us as we supported Department of Homeland Security in that DISCA mission. So even though they are incredibly talented and bright people, they're very small in comparison to DOD. So sometimes it's just a requirement that DOD get involved, and we will sometimes lead from behind to help them out a little bit.
Okay. Thanks, sir. I'd also like to kind of get to the why the Homeland Defense and DISCA missions are so important. And important for all soldiers. You know, it's not just you as the commander and whoever's assigned to R North. What should any soldier in the Army know about R North and why it's so important to understand the Homeland Defense and DISCA mission?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Again, I can hearken back to doctrine. We used to have a piece of a doctrine called Coastal Defense and Coastal Artillery Defense. It's now defunct. It's gone. But In the beginning, the last century, as we looked at World War I in particular, the only real threat to our homeland was coming from the seas, from the maritime domain. There was no cyber domain. There was no space domain. The air domain was nascent at best. Nobody could reach us with long-range aviation. So the only way you could attack an adversary was through the land domain or the maritime domain. So we built coastal artillery batteries all along the East Coast, principally, to protect us from Germany, but we did the same thing on the West Coast. And certainly when World War II started and submarine warfare became more advanced, we manned those batteries and were prepared to repel anyone that might try to attack the homeland. So that's kind of the snapshot of what old homeland defense looks like. Move forward about 100 years and you take a look at where we are now. Our adversaries out there, correction, our competitors out there, who could become possible adversaries, have closed the technological gap on us over the last 20 years. Frankly, the Russians, the Chinese, have watched us during the interwar years. They saw what we did in the Gulf War. They saw what we did in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And they realized if you give the Americans and their allies time and opportunity to build combat power in their theater of operations, they are going to win the tactical fight every time. And we did. Operationally or strategically, we're going to have a different discussion, right, about where we're at. But absolutely no doubt that we won the tactical fights in the Gulf War, in Iraq, certainly in Afghanistan. And they used the time and they used that observation to close the technology gap that had existed between us, the Russians, and the PRC. So now we see China taking the lead with hypersonic weapons. We see China leveraging artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data analytics. We see China and Russia looking to the future for what we're going to do with cybernetics and swarm drone technology and other things. They have almost reached parity with us in most of those areas. And so as they've closed that gap with us, we have to think about homeland defense differently. We can no longer put coastal artillery batteries out and then hope that our superior technology will give us an advantage. We've got to think about what it looks like when the attack comes to us here in the homeland, probably through the cyber domain or the space domain, but very possibly through the physical domains with a kinetic strike through the air or from maritime vessels or with a land force.
I think you're a Peter Zeihan fan, sir.
Do what?
Are you a Peter Zeihan fan?
I do like Peter Zeihan.
I think his works are really interesting. And he uses geography as a reason why we wouldn't get attacked.
We won the geography lottery. Yeah.
What would you say to him today? Because as you were just saying, it's not just geography anymore.
Yeah. So, and Peter and I don't know each other, but what I would tell him is, I think many of his precepts and the things that he has posited are correct, right? We have significant riches in our country with regards to our ability to produce food for our people. We have significant water resources, although we're seeing even those are strained these days. We have the tremendous geography of having two large oceans that help protect us to the east and west. We've got largely uninhabitable lands to the north. If you get above, you know, the first 150 miles in Canada, very little up there. Beautiful country, but nobody wants to live there because it's very hard to thrive. And then in Mexico, we've got a little bit more significant challenge, but we still have a benevolent and friendly partner to the south. So we do have the advantage of great geography here. But what I think that Peter often overlooks is the ability to ubiquitously spread out and touch people in a non-temporal sense. The things that he talks about are tied to the ability to move things. He talks a lot about the advent of transportation on water. He talks a lot about some of the things that we've done with regards to tribal migrations and where people have moved based on geography. But the ability to reach someone in a nanosecond from anywhere in the world through the cyber domain is something that we have to contend with on a daily basis. Space is not quite that fast, but can be, depending on where satellites are positioned and what they're trying to do with them. So I think those are great levelers of the playing field for our competitors out there. And we've got to be aware of what those attacks can do to upset the apple cart in those areas where we have advantage, whether that's fossil fuel reserves, agriculture supply, water supply. The fact that we've got great water supply here and massive rivers and the ability to sustain ourselves doesn't mean a lot if you can disrupt the water supply in Detroit or Philadelphia or Atlanta in the middle of the summer, or if you can turn off the power in Phoenix or San Francisco or somewhere else. Those things will create civil unrest and significant challenges for civil authorities and possibly for military authorities as well.
I think you kind of started to hit upon it, but you talked a lot about, you know, our competitors, potential adversaries, and more of the military aspect of threats. Are there any other threats that you could talk about in this forum that you're seeing to the homeland right now?
Well, I think we have to think about the fact that there is a constant threat from extremism of some type, whether that's imported extremism, domestic extremism. All of those pose a threat to our way of life. So that's something that we've got to be aware of. And that's not clearly delineated or assigned to the PRC or the DPRK or Russia or Iran, so to speak. And we also have to think about the fact that whether you believe man's responsible for it or not, our climate is in change, and that is creating challenges as our populations grow worldwide and as resource scarcity becomes more and more of a problem for us to deal with. Pandemics, as we continue to watch how we were informed by the growth of COVID, the spread of COVID, our vulnerabilities, the lack of resiliency, frankly, in our health care systems, which were, you know, across the world. I mean, no one was spared that, whether it was the PRC, Europe, Africa, or the United States. All of those things are the intangibles that we have to be prepared for every day.
Thanks, sir.
Sure. Thanks, Lisa. I think what we just got from General Evans was like a PhD level overview of the security situation. And what we wanted to do in Doctrine and FM30 was kind of catch up to where to the current paradigm. The Doctrine was still previous to the 2022 FM30 was still kind of stuck in the old counterinsurgency paradigm, where the threats to the homeland, there were some threats to the homeland, but it was kind of one-dimensional terrorism threat. And now, because we have peer threats that have global reach, we have to account for a whole multi-layer set of challenges. Now, you know, our adversaries aren't going to do them all at the same time, probably, but we have to be ready for them all. And I think what FM3O did was try and create a framework for how to think about all the things that General Evans just described. And so you have the domains that help kind of frame the threats, but also the dimensions, the physical, information, and human threats or factors that our adversaries can kind of pursue and combine together. It was kind of interesting. The first draft of FM3O that went out, we didn't have a lot of material. I mean, really, I don't think we had any material on homeland defense specifically. And we got a critical comment back from R. North that was really helpful. It was to, you know, add a paragraph about homeland security. And as we started thinking about this critical comment, we thought, okay, this is actually a lot bigger than just a paragraph. We need to expand this, and we need to kind of get the mindset shifted back to or shifted into the right place. So whereas before, if you were kind of a brigade S3 deploying to Afghanistan, you put your stuff on a bunch of hats or on a rail at a railhead, and then you didn't have to think about it again until you showed up, you know, at the forward staging location where you had to just account for all your stuff, and maybe there were a couple things missing here and there, but for the most part, you got your stuff. Well, now we can't assume that everything is going to there are vulnerabilities along the lines of communications that have to be accounted for. And, you know, at the lower echelons, I think it's about, you know, configuring your loads correctly so that, you know, if one or two containers gets lost or destroyed, you know, there's no single point of failure there. But, you know, especially at the division level and above, there are now coordinations that have to be done with local authorities, law enforcement, transportation authorities, port authorities. There's a whole set of coordinations that have to be done. And, you know, our North provides kind of, I think, the overarching C2 of that. But it's something that we're going to have to get better at. And, you know, what we have in this annex is just kind of a start point for how to think about the environment. But I think as we improve our systems and the policies change over time, that I would expect to see that appendix expanded and probably become its own chapter at some point in time. It's just that important.
Hey, Matt, thanks for that. And we really do appreciate CDD and the CAC reaching out to us while you were crafting what became Annex C. And you hit the nail on the head with regards to some of the considerations, right, at the tactical level that we need to think about. I just came out of a discussion with a group of general officers that are part of the Army's Strategic Education Program Intermediate Course, which is really our two-star commanders out there, sitting division commanders, or those who are responsible for two-star formations. And we had this discussion, right, about the fact that we tend to think about what do we do as we've assembled and we have moved and done our pre-combat checks and we're at the LD ready to step off, right? That tends to be where the focus of most of our tactical commanders is. I told them to think about it with regards to how do you get out of your camps, posts, and installations to project combat power forward? What do you do when you get frustrated cargo or you get transportation systems that are backed up? Or we see cyber attacks that create issues for us with our contract carriers. 80% of the stuff that's going to move from any installation to a forward theater is moved on some type of contract vehicle. It's either going to be trains, it's going to be convoys, you know, line haul convoys. It's going to be seagoing convoys that are commercial carriers, or it's going to be part of our craft fleet, our civilian reserve aviation fleet that's carrying it. We only do about 20% of our own hauling. And so that's going to create vectors for attack from our competitors and our adversaries to be able to get into our systems. Because guess what? All of those folks don't have. They don't have SIPR. They don't have secure means of communication. The information that resides in their servers and in their documentation is very vulnerable to attack and exploitation. So I've asked those generals to go back to their formations and have the discussions about being thoughtful about load plans, about how you are coordinating with the officials outside your immediate gate. How you're going to talk to people about what your deployment looks like if you're moving to Matco or Matsu or Beaumont, Texas, or Houston or somewhere else to deploy combat power. So I think that's the challenge, and that's really what is drawn out in Annex C, is there are factors you need to consider now that heretofore we didn't have to worry about because we weren't contested in the homeland. We're 100% contested right now.
The next question I have for you, sir, is really, you know, because I'm part of this generation that deployed, that we had uncontested deployment. So it's not just me, it's senior NCOs, you know, field grades, those mid-level leaders. We're used to these uncontested deployments. So I think we have this mental model that, hey, this is how you go from fort to port. Could you kind of talk about the vulnerabilities of that, but also what can we take away? What are the lessons learned from all of those deployments to CENTCOM, to EUCOM, to INDOPACOM?
Yeah, so it's a great point, Lisa. And, you know, and I, you know, am a little, so my generation's a little older than yours, but certainly I did my fair share of deploying during the interwar years there. But my first deployment in 1990 was to the Gulf War. And we were really not prepared, even though I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, and that was kind of our job. We were not prepared for, you know, a major theater operation at that point. We were still very much kind of coming out of, you know, the Soviet Union impending collapse. The wall hadn't come down quite by then, but we saw the writing on the wall. So we were all still fighting Soviet order of battle. We were thinking about what it would be like to deploy to Europe. And that's kind of the way we were set up. In the 82nd, we had to be ready to go anywhere. But as we went out the door to deploy, we were ill-prepared for that. We used those lessons to help us when we got ready for Afghanistan and Iraq. And I would submit that the folks that went out the door for those operations also learned lessons. But what happened is we started to see these, for lack of a better term, deployments of largesse, right? I mean, everybody showed up with their PlayStation and their Wi-Fi and their 42-inch television that would be in their tipper tent. You know, it was, you go to your little fob where you're safe, except for the random mortar round that comes in every now and then, and nobody can touch you. That is not the world we're going to be in. We've got to get lean. We've got to get fast. We've got to be thoughtful about MCOM control. So anything that's emitting, whether it's the watch I've got on my wrist right now or whether it's the cell phone that's in your pocket, those things are going to be targetable. They're going to be things that we've got to think about. And that targeting doesn't begin when you get to the operational AOR. It begins here at home. Right now, there are people out there. We are in active combat right now in the information environment and the cyber domain. Every day, attacks are going on. And those attacks are malicious, and their intent is to weaken our systems and to sow diversity between our citizenry and to make it very hard for our soldiers to get out and do their jobs. So if we find ourselves in a major mobilization, you've got to be thinking about, okay, what are the impacts going to be to your soldiers? Is somebody going to create a cyber attack and empty the bank account of everybody that has a USAA bank account? Because, you know, most of us are use USAA, right? It's designed for the military. I've had this discussion with USAA membership, actually. I think that's unlikely, but they could certainly spoof that, right? Imagine if you're at home with a new baby and you're deploying as a husband or wife and your other spouse calls up and goes, hey, there's no money in the bank account. I got no formula for the baby, and you're getting ready to go where? You know, these things will create incredible stress on the fabric of who our force is. And you add to that the fact that once we get to our camps, posts, and installations, we've got to muster, we've got to account for everybody, we've got to get everything loaded out, we've got to be moving to our forts, from our forts to our ports. There are great opportunities for our adversaries to interdict us at every step along the way, and they're going to. And this is the hard discussion to have with people. They don't want to believe it because their experience is, I left my, let's see, where were you at? First Armor Division? I left, were you at Fort Bliss then? Or were you, yeah. I left Fort Bliss, and I got on a bus, and I went here, and we got on a plane, and we landed there, and it was great. And I pulled out my cell phone, and I had a signal, and I called my husband or my wife and checked in. That is not going to be the next deployment. And so we've got to condition our people to understand it's not going to be like that. And I don't think we're doing an adequate job of that right now.
Lisa, there's another part of FM3O that I think relates to this. It's in the imperatives. We have this imperative about accounting for the enemy's ability to constantly observe us, and then all forms of contact. And so there were eight forms of contact that I think most people are probably familiar with. We added a ninth form of contact, influence. And this is really, this came from the force. This came from feedback that we got, that we had to account for the vulnerabilities associated with social media and people being constantly plugged into, internet and friends and family and support systems. And so, but our adversaries, as General Evans mentioned, there's an in there. And they can do things like scare families and all manner of things that disrupt the cohesion and the readiness of a formation, and getting after that human aspect, the human dimension of warfare. And that starts in competition below armed conflict, and it is the same all the way through crisis and armed conflict.
And it's something we pay attention to as a theater army, right? So we pay attention to 3-94. Division, Corps, and Theater Armies. What do I need to do to set the theater? What are those things that I have to do to make sure that the NORTHCOM theater is prepared to be able to support the combat power projection of forces to the forward theater? And those, there are people that say, this is home. We're set. We're ready to go, right? Well, not so much. We're mature. Our defense industrial base is here. Most of our power projection platforms are here. All the things we talked about with Peter Zeihan with regards to resources are here. And that's great. That makes this a mature theater. But it's not set for combat. It's not focused on defense of critical infrastructure and employment of the force the way it needs to be. So again, we go in and we look, okay, what are the responsibilities of theater armies? What does our doctrine say about that? And frankly, theater army stuff is something that we're just now getting back into. We hadn't done theater army stuff in a while. We've done ASCC things, and we did that in CENTCOM, and RCENT did that very well. And they did some theater army things. They would tell you they were the theater army. But holistically, we've not looked hard at what a theater army really does and how it enables the combatant commander and the joint task forces that are there. And then if the theater army becomes the joint force land component commander, what are his or her responsibilities? So again, hearkening back to doctrine, we're looking at and expecting and applauding the work that's being done here at the CAC on digging that stuff back out and talking about what we need to do to be successful.
Yes, sir. I think the whole point of competition below armed conflict and what we're trying to do in that context is first to contribute to integrated deterrence and do our part to prevent our adversaries from being aggressive and conducting their malign behavior. But at a minimum, hardening our protection capabilities and improving the coordination we have between different agencies, all that's going to have a deterrent effect as well. So just as we improve our protection and interoperability and things like that and forward locations, doing the same thing in the homeland is also is just as important and can at a minimum kind of decrease kind of the maximum level of aggression that our adversaries would be willing to risk in the homeland.
Yeah, and we really kind of call that denial by resiliency, right?
Yes, sir.
And then what we want to do, what we don't want to do, but what we will do if we have to, is denial by cost imposition.
Yes, sir. And that's the second part of what we do during competition, which is prepare for armed conflict. So there's kind of a dual nature to all these types of preparations.
But deterrence, I think, is as we take a look at our strategic documents, right? As you take a look at the National Security Strategy, the National Defense Strategy, deterrence is the thing that the integrated deterrence in particular is the thing that we believe is going to provide us the most advantage. Because if we can convince an adversary that the cost through any of those means is going to be so significant that the price is not worth paying, then we buy ourselves additional time. And partners and allies are a huge part of that. Making ourselves the preferred partner in regions of the world like the Indo-PACOM is a huge part of that. And then making sure that we are building redundant, repairable, resilient systems here at home so that if the strike does come through cyber or space or even through a kinetic domain, we can respond adequately and not be crippled by that.
The, you know, Matt, you were kind of talking about competition below armed conflict and that the actual doctrine in that. You first read it and it is a little scary. It's like we are in competition right now, but there's this positivity of it, of this opportunity to prepare for large-scale combat operations. And there's an emphasis of that. There's some activities, and sir, you hit upon some of them, you know, building our partnerships with allies and partners, joint interoperability, multinational interoperability, just training and leader development. You talked about this a little bit. There's one thing that I have a really big question about is setting the theater. In Doctrine, it talks about this broad range of activities.
Yeah.
So I think we can kind of like wrap our heads around, okay, we've done partnerships before, we've done interoperability before, but what are those broad range of activities in U.S. NORTHCOM for setting the theater?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We've never really approached setting the theater from a homeland standpoint, right? So when we think about setting the theater forward, we're thinking about all those tasks that you talked about, whether it's ensuring that you've got transportation networks that are agile and adjustable, whether it's the ability to provide logistics support, networking capability, the opening and sustaining of ports, those types of things. We do those routinely in a forward theater, right? We roll in and we have port opening teams. That's what they do. They open ports, you know, in areas where there might not be enough capacity that exists, or in deep water areas where they're really not doing port type operations. We have people that can come in and set a port up. We have people that go out and secure infrastructure, whether that's power infrastructure, water infrastructure. We set up our own prime power in a lot of places. We do this all over the Middle. We did this all over the Middle East for a number of years. We have people that come in and check the strength of the network for passing digital communication, the fiber network, other things. All of those things exist in the United States, but they've not been brought together, and DOD doesn't have proponency over any of them. With rare exception, right? We have a couple of military ocean terminals that we push ammunition out of, and we have most of the responsibility for that, but most of it's run by commercial contractors. So what are we doing to prepare those for massive deployment or massive movement of sustainment capability? What are we doing with the state police and county sheriff's departments to talk about securing rail and road infrastructure as we're passing huge convoys out to ports of embarkation? What are we doing to talk to fiber optic companies and cell phone carriers and satellite companies about maintaining continuity of communication in the homeland to be able to communicate freely before we push capability forward into theater? Those are the things that we talk about here. They're no different than they are in the forward theater. We've just never done it before here. And because you can't turn to the combatant commander and say, hey, you own this. Now, you know, in accordance with our doctrine, we're supposed to do that. We've never executed that doctrine. So, you know, you can't, when you go to the forward theater commander in UCOM or Indo-PACOM and say, you know, General Cavoli, you know, make the theater the way you need it. He'll go out there and he'll coordinate with ambassadors and other people, and we'll work with our country, our partners, our country teams, our allies, coalition friends, and set the theater up for warfare. But here in the homeland, all the authorities rest with other agencies at the federal level. And the Department of Defense is not the lead until designated the lead for Homeland Defense, which we've never done. We didn't even do it in our last major exercise. I continued to ask during our last major exercise, is Department of Defense the lead federal agency? And the white cell just would never say, yes, you are. So it frustrated the combatant commander, it frustrated his subordinate commanders that we couldn't get directive with FEMA, DHS, and others about what they needed to do. Realistically, I think some problems are so big, only DOD can handle them, at least for a period of time. So I envision on our worst day, if we find ourselves in a major mobilization because we have to activate a major O-plan somewhere, that we would actually be the lead federal agency for a time as the homeland's under attack. And then once we can cede that authority back to other agencies, we want to do that. That's the American way of life. We don't want to be in charge here. We want to make sure that other agencies are doing that. But as you take a look at where we are right now, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, full of great people doing great things each and every day, they are overwhelmed at the southwest border. So we're providing Department of Defense capability there because only we are big enough to do that. Operation Allies Welcome that I talked about. DHS, great people, not enough of them. They couldn't run that operation by themselves, so we provided Title 10 capability. Even though they were in the lead, and they are in the lead at the southwest border, some things are just so big that they need DOD support. So I think that's the challenge for us as we try to marry our doctrine up with our application of doctrine. Because as we think about old doctrine, air land battle doctrine, right? We used to have these big divides. We'd have the close fight. We'd have the rear area. We'd have the deep fight. We kind of scoped everything that way. And the rear area was just beyond, frankly, artillery range. Very simple. You know, most cannon artillery can't reach you here. Draw a line at 40 kilometers. Now you're in the rear area. Well, the rear area now is here, and we can be reached by everything. We can be reached by missiles from a kinetic standpoint. We can certainly be reached in the cyber domain. We can be reached from space. So it's a much more challenging proposition. And I don't think we've caught up doctrine-wise enough with it. And frankly, I think the department's got some work to do to figure out who owns what part of that fight before we ask our doctrinaires to go in and start writing the solution for us. I just had this same discussion with all these two stars at ASEPC, and they have the same concerns, right? You've got division commanders that are also senior commanders at their installations that want to know where do your authorities start at Army North and MCOMs stop, you know, as they are providing most of the resource reliance stuff. And they're doing force protection, which is a nuanced but very different thing than homeland defense. And so we've got to find a way to talk about that in more clear terms. And I think we probably owe folks a better scoping of the problem before we ask people to put pen to paper on doctrine for that. And I think that belongs with OSD policy.
You know, we're the doctrine organization, and this podcast is about doctrine. But in your engagements across our North, have you been seeing other drivers of change? So DOTMIL PFP. Do you see concerted efforts on leader development or training more maybe at the operational or tactical level that you can?
Yeah, so you know, at the operational and tactical level, we run a number of courses that are focused on DISCA. And what we're trying to do is to bring into that curriculum more discussion about homeland defense holistically. Again, the Department of Defense likes to draw a very clear line between DISCA and Homeland Defense because it's about money and authorities and resources. General Van Herk and myself, you know, my combatant commander, tend to think the two become, you know, intermingled and intertwined, you know, inseparably. That's not a popular position with the department. So we have a little bit of an uphill battle in that regard. But I think those are the discussions that we have at the tactical level with regards to the training and leadership elements of DOTMIL PF. I think what we're doing is we're pushing more forward in that space. We are building right now and working with the Department of the Army on some POM planning tasks that would deal with the organizational aspects of DOTMIL PF, certainly would deal with the manning or the personnel aspects of DOTMIL PF. In Army North, we're a little less about the materiel piece. That's really more for Futures Command and some of the folks that are advancing our modernization efforts. But I think across DOTMIL PF, we're looking for ways to make sure we check the block in all areas, right? And we will advance and mature and encourage more discussion on how we're writing our doctrine as well.
I want to shift gears to the Arctic. We hear a lot more about that these days, whether it's the climate change, which you mentioned earlier, the abundance of natural resources that potentially could be exploited in the area. China has a very ambitious Polar Silk Road initiative for the Arctic. In January of 2021, the Department of the Army published Regaining Arctic Dominance, the U.S. Army in the Arctic. A quote from that said, the Army needs to defend the homeland, compete to maintain favorable regional balances of power, and ensure common domains remain free and open. That's the end of the quote. Since the Arctic and the homeland, are overlap, what should listeners be thinking about, reading about, learning about when it comes to the Arctic?
Well, I think we need to adjust our aperture on the Arctic holistically. So, when it's funny, anytime you see a map of the world, right, from the U.S. perspective, you always see it kind of from space looking down at North America, right? And you see that we're in the center. You can see parts of Mexico, Central America, and then South America kind of slides off, and then Canada trails to the top. If you were to take the globe and invert it and look at it from the top, you would find that the Arctic is probably the most important piece of geography that we have to protect, because the Arctic approach is closer to China, Japan, North Korea, South Korea, most parts of Europe, China, than coming east or west. So the Arctic is the place that is the closest to all of our adversaries, many of our allies, and yet we tend to just think about it as the Great White North, and it's not something we need to worry about. Here's what I'll tell you is we are looking at ways to further the conversation, and I think the Army has done a pretty good job with their initial strategy on the Arctic. What we're seeing is baby steps, right? But at least they're doing some steps. The other services have not been as aggressive, and they need to start thinking about it. The Army, taking the 11th Airborne Division, and they're going out to the field for 14 days in the 25 below weather and saying, look at what we're doing here. We're learning about soldier survivability and the threat and how climate affects everything. That's important stuff, but that's not what's going to win the fight in the Arctic. We need air defense up there. We need to be able to sustain equipment in the extreme cold weather, which we frankly can't do right now. We need to make infrastructure investments so that we can climate control things. We need to put an Army pre-positioned stock up there so that when we do have to deploy forces to the Arctic, they just fall in on equipment, as opposed to taking a port approach from the maritime commons or flying things up there one airplane at a time. Because let me tell you, unless you want to get on the Alcan and try it out, you can't drive to Alaska. There are some times of the year you can't drive up there, period. 80% of what flows into Alaska comes by water through the Port of Valdez. So there's not wide understanding about that from people in the Army unless they've served in Alaska. And certainly I think holistically from a Department of Defense standpoint, we need to much more value the Arctic's position and the fact that our competitors are exploiting the space in the Arctic all the time. And as we see the climate warming and the Arctic approaches opening up more and more, you're going to see much more with regards to the trafficking of everything up there from a military standpoint with the PRC and Russia. So our chief competitors are in our backyard and they are outpacing us. It's almost depressing to talk about the lack of number of icebreakers we have in our inventory between the Coast Guard and the Navy. And Navy really doesn't even do icebreaking. So it's really a challenge holistically that's much bigger than the 11th Airborne Division going on an FTX up there. The partnership with Canada is very, very important. We kind of manage that. Certainly the 11th Airborne Division is kind of our force of choice for partnering with the Canadians because of the shared, extreme cold weather experience that they have there. But we've got to think more progressively about what we're doing in the Arctic. We're not doing enough up there.
Is there anything else before we close up the episode, sir, that you would like to share with our audience?
I would just ask all of your listeners to number one, to read your doctrine. No, I'm a doctrinaire too. I used to read doctrine a whole lot more than I read it now, but I was eager like everybody was when the new 3.0 came out to start reading that. A great, great piece of doctrine. You know, I'm an airland battle baby. That's how I grew up. So as we made the shift to, multi-domain operations or all-domain operations, I think the Joint Staff's calling it. But as we've made that shift, it's important. It's important for our young leaders to get out there and read how we do operations. So a very critical piece. And I would just say be thoughtful, too, about the homeland you live in. If you're here, if you're not forward deployed, think about what it would be like if you were directed to alert and mobilize and deploy, and what it would be like to get from your power projection platform to your port of embarkation. Where are you going to have limfacts? Where are you going to have challenges? Where do you need redundancies? And what do those problem sets look like? And you need to apply a little bit of thought equity to that, the same way you do crossing a wet gap. But thanks for the opportunity. Lisa, Matt, it was great to spend some time with you today. And it's good to be back in TRADOC land.
Thanks, sir.
You bet.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you the show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Captain Wyatt Harper. Please don't forget to subscribe on Google, Apple, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Major Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.